Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter podcast. Today, I'm joined by James. How you doing, my friend?
Great, Thomas.
Good. Nice to see you, mate. I think we've had, as we do with most episodes, I think we've had a couple of false starts. Normally, people coming on are quite busy. Sometimes I have to rebook, but I think we moved this once, didn't we? And I think it was my fault. I can't remember now, though.
Maybe moved it once. We had a great conversation about 3 months ago and then just had to find our time to get together here.
Cool. No, I'm looking forward to getting into this, James. I'm just going to do you a bit of an intro for those folks that don't know you, but we're recording this about the time of the DeepSeek news and the AI world being on fire. So there's plenty to talk about today, as well as plenty of other things. But for those people that don't know you, James, so James Wedewer started off back at Microsoft back in the day on the financial side, moved up to a management position at Market Science. You then went on to be an owner on a consulting basis of JW Computer Consulting. You were then at Accenture for a number of years, then progressed on to, again, to management at Rostores. You were then a senior manager of information security at Guidewire Software. And currently, you have moved up to director level at People AI, and you are the director of InfoSec Operations. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Thomas.
Cool. Nice to have you, mate. It's whenever I get people on at your seniority level, I like to unpack the journey and talk about what's gone on, talk about the good times, talk about the bad times and stuff like that. And I know I've done you a bit of an intro, but I'll start where I always start, which is, who are you? What do you get up to? What's a day in the life of James like right now?
Yeah, it's great from a focus. I remember looking at an MBA program, which I have my MBA, and I remember when I was applying, they were really critical about, well, who are you as a person? And student always was one of the tenets that came out. That was something the Haas Business School really talked about. I did my undergrad at Haas in Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And student always, I think, really defines me really well. I've just always been curious, always interested. Whether I was working for somebody, working for myself, doing my own things, I've really just focused on always learning, always growing as a person. And I just get interested in things and I love it. I started in college as a molecular bio major and people are always like, what, the biology? And I commiserate about organic chemistry. And if you talk to doctors, nurses, almost anybody who's ever had to deal with organic chemistry, that's usually the moment where everybody just says, oh, you survived. Oh, good for you. But I saw the writing on the wall when I did that. And I realized that other classes I was acing and molecular biology I just wasn't in it. So that's where I feel like, yeah, you get the curiosity going, you get your heart in something and I love it. I go deep. I just explore every part of it. If I'm not that interested, then it's a grind, right? It's painful. Learning that about myself and going through that. And I think that's part of why I think a lot during college and then afterwards I went in and out of working in my own businesses as well. I always have that interest to just kind of be dabbling in something. Like a lot of times they call it moonlighting, right? But to me, it's really just about keeping me active and engaged, looking at something new, looking at what else is out there going on in the world and just getting excited by it.
Yeah, cool, mate. Yeah, I love that attitude as well, that student always. I like that phrase as well. But yeah, that general attitude, if you've got that attitude, it stands you in good stead. And I've seen it both sides in my career. I've seen when people almost have got to a certain stage and they won't drop the ego and they refuse to adapt and change and won't take new things on. And I've seen people really hold themselves back from that. And then I've seen it on the flip side, like yourself, where you're forever learning and you're really, I think, being open to it as well and think it, don't always think best and always think there's more to learn. I think if you've got that attitude, I do think your progressions, there's a decent chance it's always going to run at a optimal rate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember you mentioned like first thing that you look back at my LinkedIn history, you see the first thing on there is this Microsoft position. And it was an internship. They do 6 month finance internship. So took a semester off of school and went up to Seattle. And I remember asking the guys there, hey, I haven't even taken an accounting class yet. Why did you bring me in as one of the finance interns? What was it that got you to say, yes, we want you to come and be this in our finance internship? I hadn't even done an accounting class. And they said, realistically, 90% of what you need to do, you're going to learn on the job here. It's the 10% you bring. And the particular position was a little more technical in nature, not a programmer per se, but just a little more technical in nature in the workings of finance there. And they said that was it. We figured based on our interview with you and what we talked about, you could learn quickly. And that's what we needed. We needed somebody, that was the 90%, somebody who could learn the processes here and apply them quickly, not somebody who brought 90% of skill set that they already knew, because that's just not the reality of somebody coming right out of college to in the workplace. Is you've learned things academically. Now you have to learn how to do the real world.
I think that's massive. Thanks for that, James. And I think what you've just said, I think, is becoming more and more relevant, because I know we were just talking about AI and DeepSeek, because I'm sure everyone has admitted before we hit record, but the pace that we're going to experience change at and how quickly we're all going to have to learn new things. I think that skill set that that particular guy or girl at the time spotted in you, I think that's what a lot of people are going to be looking for now, is well-rounded skill sets where people can pick new things up quick and adapt to change quick. I think the value of what you've just described there, I think, is going to go up and up in the cybersecurity jobs market as the years go on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. And did you learn a lot about finance when you were there?
I'll tell you, there's a funny reference, and among speaking to the engineers out there who usually look at the business guys on the other side of the business, wherever company they're at, and they're like, oh, doing stuff in Excel, so pedestrian. I'll tell you, when I was at Microsoft, they said, I was in a team where these were like guys who basically said, guys and girls who said, we are the Excel masters. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? There's three ways to do anything in Excel, first off. Second off, it has so much depth to the program of what you can do that they said somebody who thinks they're an Excel master probably uses 15% of the software. They told me by the time I finished my internship, I would be a master of about 25% of the software. So it is funny that way, but it was amazing at the time. I got handed one of the master P&Ls for the entirety of Microsoft for the fiscal year rollover. And you realize, wow, you have your hands on this document that has just everything in it at a roll up level, but massive scale, right? You're just looking at that thinking, wow, I have to make sure all of this ticks and ties as we're doing this rollover. So I learned quite a lot. And I'd say I found, as a student at that time in college, you find yourself working without thinking about school. It changes your mindset. If you do an internship, that's just a summer. It's 10 weeks long. When you take 6 months off and school is just completely out of the question, out of mind, you suddenly grow as a person and you get that. I had one more year of school after college, but it changed my mindset and made me start thinking about, oh, what do I actually do for work? What do I actually want to be doing after school? Because school's 4 years and work is probably another 40, maybe more. It really changed my mindset, got me prepared.
Yeah, no, cool, mate, cool. Yeah, I think as well, by the way, Excel, you'd walk all over me, James. I'm absolutely, I've got other people on the team doing it for me. And even when they just make tiny little changes, I freak out and get all stressed. So you'd walk all over me there, my friend. But yeah, just going back to that, always growing and always learning. By the way, I think it's like such a nice state to be in. Like I find it so stimulating. I see people on the team when they're growing and learning, like they're like really excited when they show up. I think it really is the key to being happy in a job or a business or at work. I think, would you say you've really got to be pretty humble? And I found you've got to really drop the ego a bit, haven't you?
Absolutely. I think going into Accenture was, I'd say, one of my first kind of real career transition after 10 years doing my own things in different businesses, coming back into Accenture as a consultant there. For starting point, I was 10 years out of school, out of college already, and switching into a big company consulting position. The biggest challenge they had in interviewing me was, do you really know what you're getting into here? And then going and doing the work, it was being humble enough to ask questions, to say, hey, I don't understand this, but doing it in the right way so that you show that you're an intelligent person, you can gather this information and synthesize what you're learning about quickly, so that then you can apply it to the particular task that you're assigned to do. And just, yeah, having that student always approach, that learning always growth approach. I came into any session where I needed to learn something or do something that I didn't understand very well with, you know, a very humble approach to it. Hey, I'm trying to learn quickly and then turn around and master the subject. That's consultant. That's exactly the point, is asking a lot of right questions, a lot of different people, putting that information all together, then being able to apply it. And in our case, deploying entities around the world for the companies we worked with was quite an experience. Being able to do that, turn that around, is a different mindset than a lot of people bring, which is why consulting isn't for everyone.
Yeah, consulting is a real skill and a really valuable one at that. And obviously, James, it all ties in with communication and stuff like that. But going back to your point about questions, I think listening and asking the right questions, I think that is like absolutely major. I'm sure it'd be nice to get your take on it, but I find it like when I'm on client calls, just asking certain questions, it demonstrates to the client that you actually know what you're talking about. It demonstrates that you listened. And if, like you said, if you're asking the right questions, it's like you're showing, it's helping you because you're getting the answers you want, but also it's helping that person see that you're on a certain level because you're demonstrating to them that you are interested, you are listening, you are intelligent, you are on the ball. You're saying that at the same time without having to say it, if I'm making sense.
I'll speak out to our probably major audience here, that you can work in technology, you can lead in technology. And let's not call the leaders business people. Let's just say it for what it is, different skill sets. Do you put the buzzword pair into a Google search and go read on this? Active listening. It's reflecting back information when during a discussion. So a person shares some information about a security tool and you reflect back, hey, what I heard was this, and confirm that with them. That shows the other person that you're listening. And do you have a follow-up question you want to add into that? It really shows that connection with the material, with the other person. It's a whole skill set all its own that I worked for years on when I was running my own business. I had a business coach that I worked with. That goes back to that student always. Look to those people around me to support my growth professionally.
Yeah, no, definitely, mate. That active listening piece, it's harder than you think. Like, I've had to get really good at it since doing this podcast, because you have to really listen when you're doing a pod. I'd like to, the coach is obviously a great one to refine and enhance that skill set. I can tell anyone listening, if anyone does any sort of hosting, any event, whether it's a LinkedIn Live, whether it's a pod, whether it's a networking event at a conference, if you want to improve your active listening skills, as well as your networking and your communication skills, I couldn't advise it any. Did the coach make a big difference, mate? A big help?
I didn't feel it as much at the moment. But what I realized was, what I didn't see as obvious, I was definitely using. It was almost subconscious that I was actively using that kind of the things I was taught, the things that we worked on. So it was helpful in that regard. And I'll tell you, when COVID lockdown occurred in 2020, the number one thing that a lot of us were talking about at that point, managing our teams, managing other people, was, are people going to be able to handle the flexibility of a work from home environment? And that was an old skill I was equipped with from years earlier with my own company, over a decade prior to that. And a lot of that was partly with the coach. You can't always be working. When you work for yourself, sometimes it feels that way and you feel like you can never take a break. And so working from home is, and I'm still working from home primarily in my company now, last couple of companies, the reality is you have to be able to block out time in your schedule and look at the, you know, you look at the ideas of work and how some of the newer generations approach it. And they talk about, oh, the millennials do this. Oh, the Gen Z's focus this way. And the nice thing about it is it's, work is adapting too, but it is sometimes hard to turn off. So especially when we've got our phone device and it's got communications and company software, and you can always be on email. You can make the last thing you do before you go to bed checking work email so easily. Like, you got to learn to stay away from those things and just not look at them. And sometimes that mindset's hard and it wears on you if you can't get it going.
It is, mate. It's great, but it's sometimes great. It's sometimes a nightmare. I'm sure you're going to say, I've got clients in their Slack groups. I've got clients that I'm on WhatsApp with. Obviously, I've got emails on my phone. LinkedIn's on my phone. And yeah, it's true. I actually think, I don't know if you've ever tried this, I've started just, not every night, because some nights I just can't help but have it by my side, but I'm like leaving my phone out the way of the bedroom now and just literally plugging it in the kitchen and just walking off. I don't know if anyone listening has tried that or if you've tried it, James, but I do find it helps my sleep.
I did exactly what you just said for years. I've gotten away from it the last couple of years. I have an automatic privacy mode. Since we don't have landlines anymore, I have a privacy mode and only a handful of things are set up as priorities so they can break through that. My SOC, phone number for my managed SOC, that's a breakthrough number, right? And then family members, a handful of family members and whatnot. But exactly what you said. I literally did that for years. It really helped to just set the phone aside, plug it in down the hallway, not have it right there next to me in the bedroom.
I think so, because like I was listening to another pod over the weekend and it was talking about anxiety levels. It was actually talking about anxiety levels and I think 18 to 30 year olds, but I think this is applicable to any age group. And they were saying a lot of it is down to what we're talking about, because we're never actually giving our central nervous system a time just to actually wind down. Because like you say, you can be emailing, you can be doing, I'm sure everyone's done it. I know I have. You can be doing work emails in bed, and then you wake up again and you're doing them in bed. And it's just, you just never get to switch off. And apparently it's linked to anxiety. But yeah, I think that's the way forward, mate. I think we need to start plugging the phones in the kitchen. But I'm pleased to hear your sock can still get hold of you. That's reassuring to know, mate.
Pager duty or your sock or whatever alerting phone number you have, whatever. Yeah, they have to be able to get to you when you're in my kind of role at 2 a.m. in the morning. I call it my 2 a.m. problem. What happens at 2 a.m.? If you can reach me or if you can't reach me, what do you need to have happening?
Cool. So I think you might have answered some of this already, but it'll be nice to hear if there's any more to unpack, James. What do you think's why, if I'm listening and I'm maybe fairly senior, but I want to get up to a director level, I'm really into progressing. I know there's maybe improvements that I need to make, but I'm not quite sure. What do you think's enabled you to get up to director level? What are the main skills you've had to enhance, refine, and improve to progress, mate?
Got it. I think when you look at manager, senior manager level roles, you're doing the work, probably leading a small team at that point, usually. Plenty of companies out there that stick the manager title on roles that have no authority over anybody in a team, but you're probably leading a team. And you're helping them manage everything and doing the work to its the most efficient, the best you can achieve. The difference is, I think the director's level, you have to start directing what work gets done now. It's not just about listening to commands from other directors or vice presidents. What do they need? It's actually looking actively at, well, what's the next step? What should we be looking at next? Can I propose something that would be an improvement for our company, for our security? It could even just be for the team. And I like that one, actually. I'll center in on that for a moment. Hey, do you just keep your team energy up and other people around you? Sometimes it's not all about, have we fixed up one more vulnerability? Are we meeting our SLAs? Sometimes it's, hey guys, let's get together and have a lunch. Just chat about life. Take 10 minutes of your, maybe have a weekly check-in at the beginning of the week. Take the first 10, 15 minutes and just chat about, hey, how was the weekend? How's your spouse doing? How's your dog? Any problems with your kids at homework? Just learn those things about the people you work with and make sure that you look at people first in that moment, because you're going to have the whole rest of the week to work together and do the business.
I think it's so easy. We've almost got so efficient these days, no, hardly any commute time, using automation when we can and this, that, and the other. And I always say about this podcast, it's of course I can do a podcast because I don't really have to drive to an office every day anymore. So I've definitely got an hour spare every week. And it's like you said, it's so easy to, we've got all this spare time. We're way more efficient. We're getting more and more efficient as time goes on. But it's so easy to just almost chase and forget about those things. I think I've been getting a bit myself. You just get lost in your own little world that's happening. And it can happen easily, mate, can't it?
Yeah. Yeah. You just, where does people fit into the equation? It can't all be about work. Otherwise, what does it say? Makes Jack a dull boy.
Yeah.
All work and no play.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, mate. So basically really looking at processes, really thinking about how people feel and having that ability essentially to look ahead and look at what's coming down the road and make the appropriate decisions accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Go look at security holistically. Find some resources out there. Just look at the whole package and you think about CISSP, for example, one of the big ISC certification levels. It's really more about managing security overall. It has several different, I'll call them silos. I think it's even at least 8 or 9, but really think about all those different areas. Is it GRC? Is it your vulnerability management program, application security, incident response, often under a SOC? What about just your participation with the sales teams, perhaps, or BizOps, your kind of day-to-day IT? They're definitely doing things that involve the security team a lot. And looking at that sales component too, I would say that's another key with directors. If you're working for a company that sells a product and security is a component of it, so you're at a security company, security software company out there, or you're in a, you know, any kind of software out there that's implemented, whether it's on-site or cloud, security is always questions there too. I think the director needs to be somebody who could be present in a sales call. They can communicate with a customer who's not technical, talk about security in a way that connects to a person who, talk to your mother. I used to remember that one. If you can explain it to your mother or grandmother for that matter, sometimes you can't. That's okay. If you can boil it down to something you could explain to your mother, then there you go. Unless your mother is one of the of the world we have. But most people get that concept of thinking like, my mom might not be smart about security technology or security concerns, InfoSec concerns. It's not something that a lot of people are really on the up and up. They hear cybersecurity and they think, well, I have a password. That's the extent of their involvement in security.
Yeah, definitely, mate. That ability to explain things concisely and clearly is huge. And I'm sure you found it as well, James, the more senior you go, or just even in general these days, people just want you to get to the point. They really do appreciate it when you can just really just nail what you're saying down into as few words as possible. People like that. And that's a really good point you make as well about getting involved with sales calls, because I think unless people are at director or maybe VP level or whatever it might be, they probably don't realize. Because I can actually remember when I first started recruiting people at director level, I can remember taking job specs off clients, and they're wanting to be that ability to jump in at the end of the sales life cycle and not necessarily close the deal, but help it along. And I can remember thinking, whoa, are these directors going to be up for this? But then as soon as I started talking to everyone, I realized that pretty much everyone had an ability and quite a bit of experience doing that. Yeah, if you're wanting to get up to that level, yeah, be aware that it's most definitely part of the job. And from my experience, anyone at your level, James, tends to quite enjoy that aspect of the job as well.
It is interesting. Yeah. Harkens back a bit to my more self-employed consulting days and Accenture consulting days too. You're in the sales process, and sales is not a dirty word. It's something that's necessary, right? Your company doesn't exist without being able to sell its product in some form or another. It's important to understand what's the customer's motivation. Why are they asking a question? Sometimes to ask a question back when they ask you about some part of your security, just so you know, what are they really concerned about? My company deals a lot with privacy because of the information we bring in from our customers. So privacy is certainly a valid concern, but every now and then a question's asked and it seems like it's out of left field and you're wondering, why are they asking that question? What are they really concerned about? And a few follow-up questions, rather than just assuming the answer, which most of us on the technical side of our work would do, a couple follow-up questions and you realize, oh, they weren't asking what I thought they were asking at all. They don't actually care about what I was about to say for an answer. Yeah. They had a whole different concern entirely. And it was more specific to them than you knew. And once you get that and you realize, oh, here's why that's not an issue. And they hear you and they're like, you hit the money, you hit the penny on the head right there. Perfect.
Yeah. I can see, is that quite easy to spot, or was that quite a hard skill to get?
I will say, I don't think that's a common skill that a lot of people get outside of salespeople themselves.
Okay.
I think that one is... I forgot who it was. I was reading through some advice and the person was talking about, as you work in your career stages, especially when you're growing, like right out of school and thinking about that, as my kids are getting older now and about to leave the nest. And I thought about that a bit. And one of the things it said was, if you find yourself out of work after, say, a first job or second job or something, you're a few years into whatever, they said, if you have nothing else, try to jump and just jump into a sales position. I don't care what it is. Just jump into a sales position because you will learn things there that you will not learn in any other role. Whatever you do, those skills you might get in a sales position, you will carry with you throughout life. And you don't think you sell, but you're always selling. You're selling that next software that you want to buy for your team. You're selling that I need another headcount in my team because these are all things that you don't develop as regular skills because you don't practice them very often. But salespeople are doing that literally every day of their job. So it is not something that we build. If you're not a salesperson, it's not a common skill set to build on the side, but yet it's so necessary and you'll do it every day of your life, all the way up to if you become CEO of a company. Yeah. What do you think you're doing at the top of the company?
Yeah.
Selling a vision, yeah. Selling people on your product or your company or services, whatever it is, you are selling. And ultimately, you're hopefully selling to the stock market or to somebody who wants to acquire your company at the end of the day, but you are selling.
Yeah, you definitely are. You could be selling to raise money. You definitely selling the opportunity to people that want to come and work with you. It's just, you're right. It's just endless. And I think that's massive, by the way, because if someone's got the skills you've just described, everything that kind of rolls into sales and communication, and you've got the technical, if you've got those two things, I think you're pretty much unstoppable. And I think that's where some people have maybe come unstuck under a tougher job market. I think that's where maybe some people with the technical skills have come a little bit unstuck, because if there was just a bit more there on the sales side, or maybe just a bit more experience in navigating certain situations. And I see it myself in my job as a recruiter. You can see some people that they're good, but they just haven't quite grasped the things that you're talking about right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. It isn't, like I said, it isn't a common skill set even as you go up, because a lot of people have never touched the sales side of any business. They've never done that role. I really thought that was an interesting piece of advice when I read it, and it just made me think. I feel fortunate that I have a stint of that in my background. And at the same time, it wasn't what I wanted to do forever. And I moved away from it. But at the same time, the skill set's with me every day.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really valuable. And I really like something you said about 5-10 minutes ago. You talked about sales not being a dirty word. And I actually see in America, people embrace sales way more. And I think it's way more respected. I find in the UK, people do. And I know everywhere, some people look down on it. But I find in the US, you guys and girls, I think you embrace sales a lot more. But probably not everyone does.
It's a very normal I've traveled a bit in Europe. I haven't made it into, more of the Asian countries yet, but and traveled around Western Hemisphere more. And I'll say that the American approach is you walk into a store and there's somebody there at the store. Media is, oh, can I help you? And 99.9% American reaction is, nope, just looking, just browsing. And the funny thing, I think it's almost actually, as I've gotten a little older and presumably wiser, I've also learned the benefit of saying, yes, I'm looking for blank. And I don't think I appreciated that one as much when I was younger, is that you spent 10 minutes walking around and then maybe you figured out, oh, I'm actually looking for something in particular. And maybe you asked a question then, or you spent another 10 minutes looking around for that one thing you were actually trying to find. But if you come in to any store, any business, and you actually are looking for something, just tell the person who's there to help you find what you're looking for. And it's amazing how 1 minute later you have in hand exactly what you needed. Then you can go browse. I definitely appreciate it. And I do look at these things. The web's a beautiful place, right? You can search anything. You could just say, what's the sales approach in France? Go look up that. Somebody's blogged about it or talked about it or written a guidebook on how to sell, if you will. I'm talking about sales here for a moment. And you might find, and I think to your point, I'd say most of the Europeans I work with, they want a consultative approach. Like, hey, I'll ask the questions, get me the information, I'll go figure it out from there. I tend to work similarly. It's if I have a need, you're not going to do a very good job convincing me I have a need I don't have. So if I've already come to the equation with a need, then I've already leapfrogged a lot of the selling process. Now I need information too. I need that consultative approach. Otherwise, most sales calls I do take, I if I'm interested in the topic, I tell them that up front. Hey, I'm learning more about this. We don't have a need for it. It's not on our agenda. It's not our what were our priorities for the year, but it's a new area. I'll a buzzword out there. I'll throw one out, non-human identity or NHI security. I would say that if you said in 2023, if you said non-human identity security, people look at you and just be like, huh, what do you mean? Explain that. In 2024, I have talked to probably at least five companies that all focus on non-human identity security. And so that's, you know, in 2025, what does that mean? is it its own subject? Could it be integrated in other tools? Yes. Some tools have pieces of it. Like anything, you look at your company's priorities, your needs, and you figure out, is this something, an area to focus in that requires its own independent tool or not? I think that applies to anything. And, you know, it's the fun part about security is there's always a new and better mousetrap out there. And it's just trying to, there's always a new mousetrap. Your job to figure out a better mousetrap.
Yeah, there is, mate. There's certainly a lot of tools out there. But yeah, I like the point as well about if you're in something for a longer term view as well, like you say, they might not be interested on the day. I think people can relate to that in a security sense. If you're in security for the long run, you can take a longer view on stuff and you can make connections and you can build connections, and maybe the job's not right for the day. Maybe you're not going to quote unquote close someone on the day, but if you're in it for the long run and you're building those relationships in a proactive manner, I find that is one of the best and easiest ways to sell. I can relate to it in recruitment because all we do is cybersecurity. So you can speak to someone now who hasn't got a need, but they'll probably have a need in 6, 12 or 18 months. But you can relate it to building your network. If you're not always trying to do stuff there and then, or close someone there and then, or only reaching out to people when you need something, or only reaching out to that director when you need a job, if you're taking a slightly more longer view and a longer time horizon, it does make the whole networking, sales, building relationships game, it makes it a lot more easier because you come across as so much more genuine, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me flip this equation around to the cybersecurity practitioners. I was introduced to a product about 4 years ago at Guidewire, and it was new. It's very interesting. It was a little bit on the cutting edge of things at the time. And we evaluated it against several other products. I don't think we even got to a POC with it because it was just not the right product for our company at the time. It didn't matter that the industry was buzzing about the company or anything. It didn't matter that it was on the edge of things. It just was the wrong product for us in that time period. Fast forward a year and a half later, I was at People AI. It was the first product I bought.
Oh, wow.
And when I put it into POC, and we did a head-to-head POC, which is a little tough to do, but we put it up against another product, and we had an incumbent that I had come to People AI that already existed there. When I put those three products up, it was easy to see the incumbent was the third place. Sorry to them. But then I looked at the other two products, and the reality of what they were trying to sell to me a year and a half prior was realized. I just was in the wrong, had the wrong environment for the product at the time. But I looked at it. It got an earnest look at from me when I was at Guidewire. I understood what they did, what it was about, and it just didn't make the cut. When I got to People AI, put it in place, saw what it could do, and I realized everything that it could do. It was perfect for us. And that goes both ways. It's like you said, this person selling needs to know, hey, there might be a long game here. Maybe it's not the right product today. Maybe it's not right. Maybe it's not a need you have today that you can prioritize, but next year it will be. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of it, for me as a practitioner too, it's, hey, this product isn't right for me at my current company, but I learned about it. I understood what it could do. And so fast forward a year and a half later, if you're at a different place, and or maybe you've got a different product at your current company that they've deployed that's just a different infrastructure, it might be the perfect product. But you have to keep that knowledge. You have to learn about that, understand what it is, and then keep that knowledge because you might use it down the road.
Yeah, definitely. No, definitely, James. Thanks. And it's a really good real life example of that. And for people listening, it can, and look, if you're on the jobs market now or something like that and you're looking for a job, I understand that perhaps taking a longer term approach might be pretty tricky, but I think it should all, if it is always taken and that proactive approach is taken, if you're trying to progress, it just makes life so much easier. If someone said to me, go and find the new client today, probably would be pretty hard, and I'd probably have to ring around everyone and ruffle a few feathers and probably annoy a few people, and maybe I'd do it, maybe I wouldn't, but it wouldn't be a very nice way of doing things. If I go, I want to build two really solid relationships this year, or three or four really solid relationships this year, it's much easier. And yes, you want to learn and enhance these sales skills, but it's a damn sight easier when you take a longer term proactive approach. And if you're staying in security for the long run, then you can, and you're in work, you can certainly afford to do it, mate, can't you?
Yeah. And I'll tell you, my official InfoSec title positions is not, it's not 20 years of history, but moving into the InfoSec community, it's collaborative. It's not as big as you think in any one area. I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area. You would think, oh, it's got to be huge there. Yeah, but it's amazing how often I keep running into the same people over and over at the different events that I go to and meetings I attend with organizations. It's really not as big as you think, even in a place like this with, I don't know what the San Francisco Bay Area is now, 5 million people, 8 million people, whatever we're up to. But you know, the larger area, it's, to your point, yeah, there's people out there in the community. I think we all look at it as we're all in the fight. We're all in the same boat. We're all trying to secure our products, secure what our people are doing, secure for our companies, our customers. That puts you all in a place where you have something in common. Mm-hmm. And everybody, I've only run into one person and he got a LinkedIn post, not by name, didn't name him, but he got a LinkedIn post from me. Only met one person where I thought, this is not somebody who's like collaborative and about growth and supporting people. He was somebody who I felt was more like tearing people down instead of building people up. One.
Okay.
In several years now, one. Everybody else is just like, James, how can I help you? James, hey, what are you working on today? What's interesting? What are you excited by? You know, like you and I talked right before we started this, we were talking a little about DeepSeek. Why is that exciting? Well, it's just the topic du jour, right? It's interesting because China put a model out there that kind of upended how a lot of people were thinking about cost of building an AI model and getting something out to market, what it costs to train and tune it to get it out there. I think Anthropic was the last one, but 100 million for their last model. And then they're saying DeepSeek was only 6 million, but DeepSeek relied on several sub-models, including other open source LLMs, to help do what it did, including ChatGPT, by the way. They pretty much did it. Somebody was tricking DeepSeek into admitting that it was basically equivalent to ChatGPT, which is, wait, why would it say that? Because it apparently had used it for some of its learning and training.
You're way more technical than me, James, and you probably understand this more than me. But am I right in saying, on a really high level way, it's basically just, in a really clever way, it's just prompted the hell out of ChatGPT? Is that basically what it's done?
It's probably too simplistic, but I'll tell you that if their approach to the model's training is really interesting, it was only a matter of time. So here, fun stuff with AI, and boil this down for our listeners. You mess with ChatGPT. If you're listening to this and you haven't used ChatGPT, please go play with it. Look at some guides on the internet about how to prompt it. The first thing I learned was give it a persona. Don't just say, what are the top 5 stocks that I should buy this year? Say, you're an investment and give it a persona. You're an investment analyst for a $1 million investor, and you want to place, this is the kind of knowledge you have, and you want to place money in 5 stocks, $100,000 a piece or something. I don't know, pick your number, $10,000 a piece. Give it a persona. It makes it 10 times, 100 times smarter about what it provides as an answer and how, and the quality of the answer. When you read it, it's not just, here are 5 stocks based on a S&P 500 index or something. It actually gives you evidence back to say like why these are substantial, or just maybe you have to ask a follow-up question or two. The next phase was people who are trying to productionalize, operationalize AI. They built a team of AI. When you think about the concept, it's, that seems so simple, but nobody had done it most people hadn't done it in the first year. And they said, what does a team of programmers look like? You probably have a manager, you have a couple of a quality assurance lead, you've got some hands-on programmers building up certain areas. So they literally wrote 10 AI personas that were equivalent to a 10-person programming team. So it's AI managing itself. all of the interactions between different programmers in the team with different roles, including quality assurance, making sure the answers are good, right? A manager, a management AI is supposed to help coordinate things. Like, it's really funny to think about it, but that's, people have written essentially AI bots this way. Now we're in that next moment where you're like, let's take it a step further and say, how do I train my whole AI to just be smarter? A Gen AI model. Like, how do I get the model to be incredibly smarter? And I said, wait a second, we have all these other models. What if we have our master model that we're trying to train, talk to a bunch of the other models, and maybe they're large language models, the LLMs, they're smaller pieces, more purpose-built. Maybe they're just talking to other Gen AIs. It's just a level up. Now, for those out there, if ChatGPT hallucinates and makes up something that doesn't exist, and you train on another model on ChatGPT, you're probably facing a garbage in, garbage out.
Okay. Issue.
And you're probably exponentially increasing the garbage in, garbage out dilemma.
Okay.
Because once you start hallucinating, I don't know, it's here's some more drugs for your AI to hallucinate on. Not a good thing to do. So I can't tell you, I'm not going to speak to DeepSeek and say, is it garbage? Is it good? I'm going to say the method is what everybody's going to be doing over the next 6 months. If everybody's not approaching building their AI models the way DeepSeek did, they're not approaching it that way, including that in their approach, they're not going to exist a year from now.
I just find it all fascinating. I tell you what I saw the other day, James. I saw this AI agency that can come into your business and basically audit your business and tell you, as a recruitment, like for us as a recruitment agency, for example, it can audit our agency and basically tell us where we can make gains. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts to that, but just in a selfish way, I don't know if you've got any thoughts to that, mate. Do you reckon it'll be any good?
Oh, I could give two examples. A friend came to me, and this was pre-Gen AI days, so machine learning days, about 6 years ago. For anybody to reference, like People AI were, I guess, about a 9-year-old company at this point in time. And you think about it, like, Gen AI is only about 2 years old. Like, stop for a moment and think about that. ChatGPT, it almost feels, I hear about it in the news all the time. It's only 2 years. Only about 2 years into that. So go back to old machine learning. This is all Python. As Python became prominent, we got machine learning and big data. The big data we talked all about in the 2010s, right? Those use machine learning algorithms. They're great. They're super powerful. They make Excel look like it's from the Stone Age when you're working with large data sets. He came to me and he showed me this product they had built up. And they went into an automaker, the US headquarters of this automaker, and put the product in. And he told me the biggest problem they had with the product was nobody believed how fast it got to the answers it got. And it's because they could drop it into, you put the product into your company's data center, essentially, and you gave it access to pretty much all of your data sets, whatever, all the inputs you have for your company. And this was a major automaker, right? So they had tons of manufacturing floor data and sales data. So they gave it access to all of this. So that's already trust level high. You got to allow that. They found initially was, they could get you answers within hours. Usually they'd give it like 1 day, but the machine learning algorithm would just run and run and run and run. It was doing all kinds of regression analysis, trying to find out what matters to your company. And then it would come out and say, here's your top 5 things about your company, or top 10 things. Here they are. Here, just have high correlation items from all this analysis. And it's a lot of this is math. It's big data math. So fun stuff. He said that with the automaker, they gave it a week. They dropped it in on Monday, implemented on Monday, and they set up a meeting for Friday morning. And they do that on purpose because the model's done in 24 hours or less. but people can't believe it can do what it can do. So then they went in, and that Friday morning, he told me they met with the leadership and they said, here's the top 7 things. Like, we reviewed these, double checked. These seem to be the top 7 things about your company. And this senior leader of the US headquarters, this automaker, just looked at him mouth open. I can't believe you have this information here. We spent 2 months figuring out 2 of the things on your list. 2 months just to figure out those 2 things. And you did it in a week without knowing that these were actual concerns in our business and knowing what we know about our business as experts in it. Your model did it, figured it out. Oh, and by the way, three of the other seven things on here, I'm going to task people to go look into immediately, because they're high probability that if the model was working on true data, those are true. And I need to go figure out exactly why and how we can adjust for those. So they were blown away. They bought that product. Great. Modern times, I'll tell you, and this is, we'll talk, prosthetize a little about what we see in the future, what's coming. I go to B-Sides and RSA here out of San Francisco, Black Hat down in Las Vegas, and you get to talk to people, different executive briefing sessions, and understand what's coming around. And a major health insurer, somebody was just sharing how, so agentic AI, to give you another buzzword in the AI community, right? Agentic AI is really AI that is tasked to actually make decisions and do something. You're not just like saying, give me back some information. You're actually saying, you know, go figure this out and then go take an action based on that information. So we all know call center bots. You get on the phone, call center's talking to you, can't do much, but it's taking you through a phone prompt system, right? It's trying to give you some answers. Every year here in the United States, we have our annual enrollment for healthcare. And so a major healthcare provider, they hire 10,000 people a year for this. They hire them in October. They train them for the month. They go and do their work from November, December. And by like middle of January, they're all laid off. It's a temp position. That's it. But they spend a month training, maybe more. And then they spend 2 months doing their job. And they're supposed to know 600 different policy documents about health insurance plans and answer questions for customers. So they looked at their analysis and they're like, the people were about 65% accurate. You hear the phone, oh, this call may be monitored for server development. Yeah, that's what it's all about, is they're probably recording, or they have a bot listening and transcribing everything. And they have to make that same notice. It may not be a human. It might just be transcribing it for it. And so they're thinking 65%, that's not very good, right? Shouldn't be very good. You're asking questions about your healthcare policy. And if they're inaccurate a third of the time, that's really not very good. So then a company came into them and said, hey, we can train a bot for this. We'll train an AI system and the AI will be the prompt. Voice prompt's great. And we all saw what, who did that? Was it Google that had that? The Scarlett Johansson voice, her basically open, oh, ChatGPT did it with, I think, with GPT-4.0 version. That's right. That's what it was. So they said, we're going to prompt this thing out a couple years ago and we'll just run it on the side. We'll see how it does. It was like 95% accurate. The trippy thing was they do the customer survey. The bot was more personable on average. And it's because if you have an 8-hour workday, the bot's just as effective in hour one as it is at hour eight. It doesn't need a coffee break. It doesn't bring, oh my gosh, my kid had a blowout this morning, was all mad getting out to school, and I didn't come in with a bad mood to work or a headache. None of that. The bot's just as good all day long as the first minute into the last minute. And so it wasn't as personable as humans could get, but it never had a bad day. So it's just consistent. So they said, this is really interesting. And you could have a bot as your sidecar, right? It could aid humans. I want the human to be more accurate. If it's transcribing in real time in front of a human customer service agent, the bot can suggest documents for them in real time. Pretty cool. But let's take it a step further. Apparently the bot was so effective that the next year they tried to do it with half the workforce, 5,000 people instead of 10,000 people. And they put the bot in place and the bot was so good that my understanding, and whether this is true or not, it was a plan, whether they did it or not, because it was just this last year, it would have been true. They only hired enough people to be the like escalation point when a human is absolutely necessary. And the bot, the voice bot, was going to do almost all of the open enrollment Q&A on the phone with people. That's agentic AI realized right there. And it's a temp job. I'm not saying that AI should be replacing humans in all kinds of places, but I'd rather those humans be doing something that's more value added. Globalization changed it. The United States was an agrarian economy, and then it was we made cotton, and then it was a manufacturing economy, and now we're more of an information economy, and various parts of our leadership want to bring back a certain amount of manufacturing economy. Those are all great. I don't need to go back to agrarian economy except for what I need. I have lots of machines and everything that I only need, what, 1/100 the number of people to have a field of corn today than I did 150 years ago or 300 years ago. So AI is doing that. It's making it more efficient. And by the way, remember, it was better than the humans at being accurate. great about the responses it was giving. So this is the reality coming down the road. We'll find a balancing act for it, and we'll lose some position, some jobs, and we'll gain a whole bunch more. Yeah. There's lots of analysis out there. World Economic Forum just published a paper that's actually interested in reading. Go look it up about the future of work. Try to read the summary. It's hundreds of pages long. Pages long. Look for some summaries about the future of work and AI. And they're talking about how, like, in certain models, AI will have net fewer jobs because of AI. But in other models, they're actually questioning whether or not it'll create more jobs. Okay. It's an interesting balance. We'll see. We're only a couple years into the realities of Gen AI.
Either, James, read the summary or get ChatGPT to summarize it.
Absolutely. Oh, perfect use of ChatGPT. Please summarize this long email into the top three bullet points. I love doing that sometimes. It's really fun to do that. It's usually really good.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And it's true. It's like the analogy of like man and machine, and like when farmers used to pick the crops and then they got the machinery. It is one of those moments, and it is going to be fascinating. But yeah, so basically your answer is yes, definitely get an agency to audit your business and see what you could be doing with AI.
Why not? If you can trust the company that's involved in it, as a security practitioner, it's one of the first things I'm ever looking at is if I'm putting a tool in for vulnerability management or something, that's some of the most sensitive information about my operational infrastructure that anybody could possibly have. And a lot of these tools are cloud-based today, so they're not on-prem. They're not in my own data center, right? We put them into AWS or GCP cloud, and we run it all there. And then the provider might be in a different cloud than the cloud you're running on. And that's a scary moment to think about overall. They do all the same checks. Is their security decent? Is it going to protect my data when it's in their hands? And great. But now and some of these security tools, they're heavy Gen AI and they're heavy learning systems. They'll learn about your system over the course of a week and they'll tell you what's normal. And then they'll tell you what's not normal. That's the not normal stuff is how they alert. It's the idea of SIEMs was supposed to, and end user behavior systems. Supposed to be the holy grail. And EUBA was the big buzzword, four letter acronym for end user behavior analysis. And those are security tools to say, oh, it learns over a couple months what's normal in your environment, what's not there. And the reality never quite got realized, but I think it's because they were relying on machine learning and what they needed was Gen AI. They needed the power of these LLMs and Gen AI to do what they really wanted to do. Now we're seeing tools that they don't call themselves SIEMs anymore. They call themselves something else. They've got different names depending on what they're focused on. And it's cool to see what they learn. What they find, because they go dig through your data in ways that we as humans can't understand this. I talked about going back to like big data, and that's when I learned Python machine learning back in the day versus Excel. I could blow up in an Excel slide of like 1 million row limit. I'd bring in 8 million row data sets. In Python, I'd get an analysis done in 2 minutes. The 1 million or 100,000 row data set sometimes I'd work with would stick Excel on my computer running for 30 minutes just to get to an answer. And then here I am doing 8 million rows of data, massive data sets in 2 minutes and getting better information and being able to iterate over that 15 times in the same amount of time that Excel could only do one calculation because of the size of the data and efficiency of the system. Keep moving, keep growing. And be ready for the next tool that can help you make your life easier and get you to answers that you couldn't get to before.
Yeah, thanks, mate. We really are in, talk about the industrial revolution, we really are in a digital revolution now. And I think these next few years are going to be really interesting. And I think probably the last question, James, is any tips for kind of staying on the right side of it? Because I think there's going to be some big losers and some big winners. Have you got any final thoughts in terms of how to make sure you are on the right side of this digital revolution that we found ourselves in?
Oh, I wish there was some magic bullet out there that I could take for certain, like, yeah, do this. I'll tell you, I feel for all of our programmers today. And I think part of that is that they're just constantly learning a new language, relearning some aspect of it. We didn't talk about Python 15 years ago. So, you know, you could be a master of a programmer in C++, hopefully that makes you good, but you got to learn Python and then you got to learn Ruby and then you got to learn Java and different flavors of things along the way. You're constantly learning and growing. It's a tough grind on the programming side and the engineering side to keep on top of that in the software business. Overall, I think it's, we talked a bit about people. For those out there, is stay on top of people and know what your value is as a person that can bring value to a company. What can you do for them? When I came into my breakout to information security was, I'll call it an extracurricular years ago, because it was a leader in the information security team at my company. I was in a position that was more program management, technical program management. And so I worked on different projects that would touch all of the silos of the company's technology. And one of the persons just knew I was really good at synthesizing a lot of data into actionable information, because I worked did a lot of strategy work where I had to work with a lot of data in my team and then actually looked at the business and said, what can we recommend from this data? And then present those ideas to our leadership so they would agree or disagree, and we'd take action on those things. A bit of a business strategy team / business intelligence hybrid, if you think about it that way. And one of the persons just came to me and said, hey, I have this problem with this security issue we're dealing with. We have a massive amount of data. We're trying to figure out what matters. How do we work with this? I helped them build out a workable model. Mm-hmm. And then they took it back and they had the teams implement it on the servers in our data center and operationalize it. And that was my first foray into vulnerability management. And fast forward two other companies, I've now built vulnerability management programs. Mm-hmm. but it was just an introduction to cybersecurity and information security and vulnerability management years prior to that, where that person said, hey, can you help me with this? And I helped them with this. I also learned then what they were trying to do, grew from that. Back to your people then too, and look for those opportunities. I mean, that person saw what I could do and they were the ones who suggested, hey, you can be good in information security. So help me make the connections to get there and get that first interview. It's, I always tell people to think about what's the job of your resume? It's to get the first interview. What's the job of the first interview? To get the next interview. Mm. After that, you're probably in the cycle and point where, yeah, everything's going to come together and you're either going to get the job or not. But that people component is huge. And knowing what you can do, what you can bring to the organization, if one person can get you the introduction to the person you need, the hiring manager or a leader of a team or something, just to give you that first pass, then you just, that personal connection will get you started. Everything else from there, yeah, that's on you and your resume and your experience. But articulate then what you can bring, what value you can provide, what you can do for them. And that's a self-awareness question too.
Mm. Mm. Cool, mate. Yeah, thanks for James. It's a really nice way to finish, mate. And yeah, just ability to pick new things up quick and being adaptable. Like, I'm like really getting that from you. And yeah, mate, it's an interesting time. And thanks for taking the time. I know I promised you an hour and we've gone way over. So thank you, mate.
All right. No, good conversation. Don't need a time limit.
Yeah, no, definitely, mate. Yeah, it's a really interesting time. I think we're going to look back on this period of life as just like the kind of wild, I don't know, the wild, there's so much going on in the world right now, in the world in general, in politics, with AI, tech, like it's all, whoa, like it's hard to keep up, but it's very interesting. Thanks, mate. It's been really nice. It's been one of those episodes where we've just freestyled all the way through, but they're the best ones because they're natural and they're flowing. And I think they're the best for the listeners as well, mate. Thanks for unpacking your journey and giving us some good insights, especially the AI stuff as well and the progression related stuff. It's all been really good. Thanks, mate. And nice to see everybody.
You too. I've enjoyed talking through it all and I hope the listeners find some value in it.
Cool. Thanks, mate.